Good morning, everyone. It's nice to be with you today. Thanks for being here. And for those of you who are fathers, I want to wish you happy Father's Day. Thank you for your work of shepherding those little bodhisattvas in your care. And thank you for the continuous practice that parenting is. It benefits all of us. And happy Juneteenth, happy Pride Month, happy Solstice, happy summer, and if today's your birthday, happy birthday. So it has been 3.5 months since we have physically come together as Sangha. It's been about a month since the horrific death of George Floyd and the eruptions that followed. And we are 15 days into the 49 days of mourning that clouds began following Mr. Floyd's death. And when I sat down to write this talk, a question kept coming up that just would not be put down. And the question is, how is everyone doing? That's what I want to know. How are you? How am I? I don't always know how I am. So today I'd like to invite conversation with you about that. And what I'm going to do is offer a few reflections on what I'm feeling and observing. And then I want to turn the floor over to you, to all of us, for conversation with each other. I myself am really feeling the loss of Sangha. The obligatory thing to say is, don't get me wrong, Zoom is great, but I miss being with people in person. I miss being able to hug one another, look into each other's eyes, and I miss the opportunity for a spontaneous interaction that only can happen when people are together. In the weeks since the death of George Floyd, when I've asked people how they're doing, the most frequent answer I have heard is heartbroken, or my heart just aches. I think I've heard it more in the past 30 days than in my entire previous life. And the truth of it is, our hearts were stretched to the breaking point even before George Floyd's death. COVID has stripped so many people of so much. Family members, friends, jobs, those are the big losses. But there's been a series of small everyday losses as well. Daily routines that nurture us and bring us joy. Long planned vacations have gone out the window. Weddings, funerals, cups of coffee with friends. It seems to me that loss and heartbreak are in the very air that we breathe these days. COVID has left no area of our lives untouched by heartache. And the tragedy and the trauma of George Floyd's death has only multiplied that sense. I've been reading what I think is a very important book called The Wild Edge of Sorrow, Rituals of Grief and the Sacred Rituals of Renewal and the Sacred Work of Grief by psychologist Francis Weller, who has done grief work for the past 30 years. And in the book, Weller explores the relationship between personal grief, the kind of sorrow we suffer when a loved one, for example, and cultural grief. The sort of grief we suffer from horror, such as the killing of George Floyd, and so many other Black and Brown men and women. Species extinction, school shootings, incarceration of little children. The list of cultural griefs seems endless. Weller proposes that we don't always pay proper attention to these cultural griefs as our own grief, in large part because our culture is death and grief phobic. We're constantly in a rush to get back to business as usual. Our culture has a hard time accommodating the messiness of grief that has no timeline, no predictability, and often renders us unable to pursue our ordinary lives. And yet we register loss in our very bodies, the cultural losses no less than the personal losses. Grief is a massive, tremendous energy. And when it's recognized and expressed, it can transform us in wholesome ways by connecting us to our own tenderness and to others. And when it's unrecognized, ignored, kicked aside, or minimized, it still expresses its potent energy, but in harmful ways, by exploding into rage, by hardening us, and isolating us from one another. This transformation that takes place through the engine of grief, for good or for ill, is not just personal. It's cultural and political as well. We don't often think of heartache as belonging in the realm of politics. It may seem too sentimental for this power game that our politics have become. But in my lifetime, what I know, in my lifetime, every meaningful social and political change, meaningful in terms of enhancing ordinary people's lives and dignity, has been achieved through what we might call the politics of the brokenhearted. The politics of the brokenhearted, that is not a term original to me. The psychologist and cultural activist Parker Palmer coined it in a 2004 essay on democracy. The politics of the brokenhearted has shown up in the Black Lives Matter movement, the civil rights movement, indigenous land movement, LGBTQ, immigrant rights, environmental movement. They all began with and are sustained by people who have harnessed the energy of heartbreak in ways that connect rather than isolate. Weller proposes that spiritual maturity comes from a willingness and ability to enter into what he calls an apprenticeship with sorrow. And I love that term because it kind of forces us into looking at grief and sorrow as a journey rather than an event that we move through and then get on with our lives. He writes, "We must learn the art and craft of grief, discover the profound ways it ripens us and deepens us. While grief is an intense emotion, it is also a skill we develop through a prolonged walk with loss. Facing grief is hard work. It takes outrageous courage to face outrageous loss." As I have reflected on what it means to be Sangha in these days of social distancing and upheaval, it has occurred to me that heartbreak and this apprenticeship with sorrow is encoded into the very mission of Clouds in Water Zen Center. That mission is to awaken the heart of great compassion and wisdom. And the truth of it is, only a heart that's been broken open can be awake and compassionate and wise. And the world right now is an invitation to enact our third great bodhisattva vow and enter the Dharma gate of heartbreak. How to do that is the question. How to do that without being swamped by the pain of grief and the overwhelming urge to do something. Do something to change the conditions that have brought pain to so many. But I think we have a very potent example in our practice of how to do that, of how to enter into a relationship with our heartbreak in a way that liberates rather than imprisons. And that example is Shakyamuni Buddha himself. There's a profoundly important point about his journey to awakening that we tend to overlook. And that is that his awakening began with a broken heart. Using Weller's framework, we could say that Shakyamuni Buddha's entire journey was an apprenticeship with sorrow. The story goes that young Indian prince Siddhartha Gautama, the name of the Buddha before he became the Buddha, was destined to succeed his father as a king in a region of northern India. And as such, as royalty, as a noble, he lived his life blissfully sealed up in the splendor of his several palaces, amply supplied with every pleasure that he could possibly want, surrounded by servants who were at his beck and call, shielded from the realities of life. He didn't entertain even the faintest suspicion that life could offer anything other than an endless succession of amusements and pleasures. Except that he must have had some inkling that life offered more. Because one day in his 29th year, curiosity, or maybe boredom, led him to order his servant to prepare a carriage and his horses so that he could venture out beyond the palace walls into the city. And there, the story goes, the rose-colored glasses that had always been his lens to the world were ripped from his face with his first encounter with the suffering of the world. And that encounter came from what we call the four divine messengers. And these messengers were a bent and decrepit old man, a sick person, excuse me, a corpse, and a wandering monk. And thus did Siddhartha encounter old age, illness, and death for the first time. And in the wandering monk, he saw the possibility of a different way to live life. So how did Prince Siddhartha respond to the four divine messengers? What did he do when the realities of the life that he had so carefully been shielded from were laid bare in such a shocking and traumatic way? Put yourself in his shoes and reflect on how you would feel to discover the folly of the narrow view of life that you have led. The shock of realizing your illusions. He didn't go home and indulge in distractions that would help soothe his pain. He didn't turn away. He didn't get busy doing something else that would help him forget what he had seen. He didn't project his dismay onto others, as we have a tendency to do when we encounter the other. He didn't harden his heart. Rather, he responded with what in Sanskrit is called samvega, wise urgency. He allowed himself to be shaken. And he knew his life could never be the same. So over the objections of his father and the rest of his family, including his young wife, who had recently given birth to their son, he abandoned his royal station and went into the wilderness, the forest, in order to get to the bottom of the suffering he had seen. He'd entered the Dharma gate of his own heartbreak, not knowing what the outcome would be. And this is important, that he didn't know the outcome. He undertook an open-ended journey. 2,500 years later, we might look on it and say, well, of course that was going to turn out well. That he's the Buddha. And it did turn out well for him, but it didn't initially turn out well for him. He had fits and starts. He took the wrong path. He took the path of deprivation before he discovered that wasn't the way to go. And it almost killed him. When he set off into the forest, having lost absolutely everything, the only thing he knew was that he had no choice but to respond to the promptings of his heart. And I think this is exactly the moment we are in. Ironically, even as COVID-19 has kept us confined to our homes, it has thrown us outside the palace of our comfort zone and into a world that we're not sure how to negotiate. And the death of George Floyd and its aftermath has shaken us to the core. As well, it should. As well, it must. As was true for Siddhartha Gautama, it has stripped us of many illusions and brought us face to face with realities we cannot ignore. Illusions that have to do with American identity. Illusions that have to do with our own identity. So what do we do with that? How do we hold it? How do we support one another in holding it while at the same time letting it shape us and move us into right action in this great transformational task that is before us? I have been thinking a lot about that fourth divine messenger, the wandering ascetic, the wandering monk, who showed Siddhartha that there's another way to live besides being locked up in ignorance. And I've asked myself, who are our 21st century American wandering ascetics? Who are the divine messengers among us now who have relinquished comfort and security to go into the world and offer us a different an example of a different way to be? And the people who have emerged for me as divine messengers in our time and place are the Valerie Castiles, the Tracy Martins, the Philanese Floyds, the mothers, fathers, sisters, and brothers of slain Black men and women who have taken their grief and put it in the service of transforming the systems and conditions that killed their children. Valerie Castile is Philando Castile's mother. She was at the state legislature on Saturday pleading with legislators to enact police reform, to compromise, to begin this process of transformation in that system. They didn't do that. They failed to compromise. But Valerie's voice rang out clear and strong to me as an example of what we have to do. Philanese Floyd, George Floyd's brother, the day after George Floyd's funeral, went to the United Nations and requested that that body investigate the murders of Black men by police in this country. That's giving us a divine message. We can say the same thing for the parents of the children who were killed at Sandy Hook, who have been so relentless in trying to achieve gun reform. We find the divine messengers in the Dakota people whose lives have been shaped by a catalog of losses, beginning with their land and their way of life, who continue to show up and speak their truth in the service of justice. These are our divine messengers, our wandering monks, who by their presence and their actions cajole us and prod us into seeing loss and heartache and grief as the instrument of transformation that it can be. So as COVID restrictions begin to lift and we start to resume some of our normal activities with a little bit more freedom and get a taste, a blessed taste of the joys of summer, and don't we all need that? And as the raw horror and trauma of George Floyd's killing gets further away in linear time, let's be very careful to remember that the heart does not beat to linear time. Heartache knows no chronology, and neither does it respect artificial boundaries between public and private. I believe the great work of tending to our heartache is tending to the heartache of the world. This is our bodhisattva path. Continuously tenderizing ourselves is continuous practice. It creates the possibility of a more tender world. Tender but fierce. Let's not mistake tender for soft. Tender is fierce because it is tenacious. Tending to this heartache of ours is itself, I believe, a form of spiritual activism that can lead us to a politics of caring instead of a politics of power gaming. As Prince Siddhartha Gautama taught us, we cannot know where our broken hearts will lead us. None of our 21st century wandering monks, the mothers and fathers of our lost children, and they are our lost children, signed up for their prophetic role. They simply responded to what was needed. They took the next appropriate step. And that is all we can do. And I think that's what we can do to help one another through this transformational moment. As a sangha dedicated to awakening the heart of great wisdom and compassion, my deep hope is that we can support one another and encourage one another on our path of tenderizing our hearts in the service of the world. So that's all I want to say. I don't want to be so boorish as to ask how you are and then talk for the next 40 minutes before you have a chance to answer. So I'd really invite you to speak your heart in response to anything I said. I invite you to converse with one another here. And just talk about how you are. I thank you for your kind attention to my words.
Toku, I want to thank you. This is Martine, real quick. I appreciate very much what you had to say about the fact that people, the mothers and the fathers and the relatives of the folks that have been killed have stepped up to do stuff, not in the understanding the role and not knowing where they're going. And I know from history, we know famous names and big names, but behind all that, there are always people in the background, women, kids, people that were either organized or doing the logistical work. And we know the famous names, Dr. King, Angela Davis, Cesar Chavez, et cetera, all the, anybody in history. But it's always some small number of folks, individuals who move that, whether they want to or not, they're just compelled to do that. And I appreciate that you're saying that, because I think a lot of people are, might think, well, what could I do? What am I, what can I do? Is this such a big thing?
It is a big thing, but yes.
Yeah, what you can do spreads out.
Yeah.
I was with an organization, I'm still involved in LA, that's been around for 30 years. A lot of the folks that have come through through the school that we had for organizers and training, they're all over the place making some, you know, I see them on Facebook doing all sorts of stuff. And it just takes seeds to be planted, and that's what's coming up. Those seeds that have been planted 20, 25, 30 are coming to fruition, and you can, in whatever small way you can, make change. So please don't think anything's insignificant. I think that's where you're going with that. But if not, I think that's a good place to start.
Thank you very much for that. Yes. And you know, Martine, if I could just add this, those organizers that you helped train 30 years ago had people behind them who created the conditions for them to show up, and on throughout space and time. We don't know. We don't know the effect of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. No, we don't know the influence, yeah. And by the way, I'm feeling hopeful for things that I haven't felt in a long time. So,
despite everything. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. It's different this time.
Toku, thank you for your talk. what I was thinking about, is you do have this reaction as a privileged white person. What can I do?
Yeah.
And I think there is the more direct view of just how do I interact in the world? How do I address racism in my daily life and the people I engage with? But what can I do? And obviously this is about people's individual behavior and racist beliefs and actions, but we're at a place, I think, in our country where we're living our lives, and many of us, I mean, all of us are racist at some level, and we've been raised in this culture, but we're also really consciously trying to not be and to try to do better. But I think we're at a point where our institutions have built racism into them, and everywhere in our lives, and so it's being perpetuated and continuing on despite even what we might be believing at this point in cultural change. And so what strikes me is that part of it is looking at your daily life and even your place of employment and the where you engage and where you work and being conscious of how is the work I'm doing or the action I'm taking or the way I engage with my neighbors, how is that impacting people with brown and black skin? And is there something we need to be doing differently here so that we're not perpetuating housing discrimination, and job discrimination, and healthcare? I work in public health. Population health discrimination. And because you get trapped in like, well, what can I do in my daily life? And there's obviously community involvement and action, but I think it's in your work. I think it's wherever you go as a white person starting to think about, how do I do this differently? And have I thought about how this is impacting key people? So I'll just stop there. That's a way to take action.
Oh, it is indeed. And you know, there are many systems of injustice, many systemic injustice. We're all involved in systems. And that vigilance for the systems that we are a part of, I think that's what you're talking about. Yeah. It's essential.
I'll just say one thing, which is I appreciate your invitation to be broken. That's really important for me. I like to have it all together. Yeah. And I can't hold it together these days. I can't. And I shouldn't. That's what I heard you saying. Let's stop with the, we've got this all together. We know the solutions. I've got my little five things I should do today. I can't operate in that world right now of my lists and ideas. And I think that's really where we all need to be. And have also what I heard you saying, I can have some faith that I can just go forward into that. And I don't know what will come out the other side. I can't say next week I'll be doing this, this, and this. I don't have any idea where this is leading for me personally and for us collectively. And I think that's fine.
I really honor your recognition of the need to stop. Yeah.
So I heard you talk about, you know, like, so how are you doing? Like, how are you really doing? And I think part of what happens when I, because it is so big and it feels like so hard to take in, that right away I want to fix it.
Yeah.
And you and I were talking about this yesterday. And then the thing is, like, so how do I back off a little bit? Not to not take any action, but to know that it is way bigger than I am. And then if I can, this is what I've been working on, is I'm working on my own stability and my own resources, and my resources are different now than they were before. And so I think what we're facing as a Sangha is, how can we be here for each other in a meaningful way, really connecting in deep, deep, intimate ways, given this new reality. And how can I work on my own stability? This is my question for me. How can I work on my own stability whilst allowing my heart to break open and be broken? And then allow that to inform what my next action is, not to not act. I don't want to get stuck in the, it's the analogy of the airplane. You know, if we're going down and I need to put my own face mask, I need to put oxygen on first. And then it doesn't mean I'm going to ignore the little kid beside me. I'm going to give them, but I'm going to make sure that I get oxygen. So, and it's a, you know, and then, I think the fear of not being perfect. What was it? Who was it? Ah, it was Genjo last week. He said, you know, I try, I fail. I try, I feel better. And just to keep, to not let the knowing that I'm not even perfection is not even, it's just like, I'm going to be an idiot, but I'm just going to keep moving forward and I'm going to learn as I go. So thank you so much for your talk. And thank you everyone for being here and showing up.
You know, the teaching of emptiness is really helpful when we all say, yes, this is so big, but the teaching of emptiness tells us that the very large is as the very small, because there's really no boundaries and no outlines. The workings of our heart are the workings of the world. The hardness of our heart is the hardness of the world. It's as vast as the universe and as small as our flash of anger at the dog. That gives me great comfort.
I'm probably preaching to the choir here, but you know, the way Juneteenth was celebrated a couple of days ago and many things is there was a lot of education going on about what Juneteenth is and the roots of Juneteenth. And it feels to me like a big thing of what I feel I need to do, and I've been working on it more and more, is to educate myself and to no longer be okay with putting my head in the sand, to bear witness and to know and explore the deep suffering of people who have been oppressed. And so I guess it's becoming uncomfortable with what has been and to find ways to know what's been and to find ways to change that in my own actions with the knowledge of what has been and saying it's not okay and this is what I want to do next. And so I've been doing this little thing, and actually I'm the kind of person, if I'm walking around, I usually will say hello to somebody I pass by. But right now I'm particularly making sure that if I'm passing by a person of color, that I am giving an exuberant hello to them, to acknowledge them, and to acknowledge our relationship to each other. And in some way, it's a small thing, but I feel like all these little small things add up. And that's one thing I can do easily and want to do, even if it feels a little uncomfortable. It's hello. And, you know, so that's what I want.
Thank you, Mio Ohm.
Thank you for your talk, Toku.
Hey, Jay.
What I heard a lot was permission to feel and attend to whatever's arising. And for me, part of healing the world is also healing myself. And sometimes the correct action is not to do anything, but it's to feel. And I've been noticing this past week, I've been really shut down, and I got some news that someone that's really close to me is going to go away. And I'm so grateful that I know, because I can prepare. And every moment is so much more precious. But the anticipated loss is huge. And for me, when you read off Ayanna Dior's name, my heart broke for all my trans brothers and sisters. And as I undo my own transphobia, because I have so much internalized transphobia from our culture, it hurts. And the only way to undo it is to be vulnerable. and is to share my pain, because my pain is your pain. And I'm so grateful for this Sangha. And I'm so grateful for the person that I know is going to leave in a few months. And she was one of the first people that, like, saw me. And it's so beautiful. And it just reminds me of the impermanence and how precious life is. So thank you. Your talk really just allowed me to remember I have permission to feel. And sometimes that's what I need to do to heal myself and the world. So thank you.
I honor your courage, AJ, to feel.
This is Carla. Thank you, Toku, for your talk this morning. You know, you talked about wise urgency, and one of the places I first tend to go is, what can I do? And I think in this particular time, I'm trying to ask myself, well, how can I be? How can I be differently than I was before? How can I listen more deeply? How can I learn? And I've found that during this pandemic time and since the murder of George Floyd, my emotions are very changeable. You know, one minute I'll be somewhat optimistic and hopeful, and then I'll be despairing and discouraged. And things that I'm 63 years old, and things that I thought I had long processed, you know, old hurts that are personal, you know, related to my family or previous relationships. I mean, they're just coming up, and I find myself, you know, crying in the bathtub, and things that I didn't expect to be processing again. And, you know, because of the pandemic, we've all spent more time, either if we live alone or if we live with our family members, there's just more internal time. And in some ways, that's really good, because I see that there's another layer for me to work through. So although this is really hard, I'm on a deeper level appreciative that it's happening. So thank you.
Hi, Toku, it's Seamus.
Oh, hi, Seamus.
I just wanted to thank you for reminding me to keep everything unresolved. Coming from a position of privilege, it's easy to take two or three action steps and then mentally convince myself that that's okay, and that I'm not feeling things anymore, and that I've somehow compartmentalized my feelings into an easily resolved location, when that's never true. And that's not the Buddha way of going about things. I need to keep my pain and uncertainty open in order to continue to empathize and continue to develop new actions. So that was my main takeaway, and I wanted to share.
Oh, thank you so much for that. Thank you so much. Yes. Yes. Very nice. Very well said. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. COVID, like as Carla just pointed out, and Seamus, it's made it more difficult to compartmentalize, because we're just face to face in a new way with so much. I mean, there's always the potato chips to go to, true. But there is the space there. Sometimes it feels like too much space, but it
and can. Coin chips.
And corn chips.
Don't forget the ice cream.
Okay, right.
Toko, thank you very much for your talk. We're going to end now.